Hello and welcome to another episode of Trailing Blazers. I'm your host, Dan Maring. As always, we're part of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. You can find us pretty much anywhere you're looking for your podcast needs, iTunes, and now a part of Dash Radio. And we've got a heck of a show for you this week. My friend and friend of the show from Sports Illustrated, Ben Gulliver, is going to join us to discuss the comeback kings of Portland Trailblazers' second half of the season and how they went from 11 games under 500 to back to 500, making the 8th seed in the playoffs. From there, we'll kind of take a look forward, featuring the matchup between the number 1 seed Golden State Warriors and number 8 seed Portland Trailblazers, and how that series is going to play out, the effect of Yusuf Nurkic, whether or not he plays or doesn't play, and what Portland really stands to gain from this series, and if they really have a chance or not. From there, we'll take a look forward to how Portland's offseason could play out once the playoffs and the finals do wrap up, as Portland heads into the draft with 3 draft picks, and how their current salary cap situation is kind of piecing together. So we've got a lot for you to kind of go through on the basketball side of things, and then we'll kind of tie into something a little bit more fun at the end of the show when we're done with Ben. Just take a look at something we've been playing with for a while here, but we wanted to bring it into the show, and that's our NBA Netflix featuring various NBA players and how they may tie into a remake of some popular movies over the course of the years. And when we get done, we'll go ahead and ask for some submissions and feedback and see what everybody else can come up with. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get right into it, my friend Ben Gulliver. All right, and now we're going to be joined by Ben Gulliver, good God, from Sports Illustrated, a good friend of mine. I've known him for a long time and a friend of the show and a guy who's definitely got some background in dealing with the Portland Trailblazers. Ben, glad to have you, man.
My pleasure. How's it going?
Not too bad. It's been kind of weird here lately. It was, you know, good to have you in town for the Nike Hoops Summit, so we got to catch up a little bit and talk a little bit of hoops. And it's been kind of this weird back and forth where you and I have talked about things that we expect to transpire on the court for the Blazers, and it's kind of flown back in our face as far as how some of these games have turned around. There was the game against the Spurs, and how Portland's kind of performed with and without Nurkic, and how we kind of expected them to close out the season. They've really been kind of surprising. So just real quickly, kind of sum up the last 2 weeks or so of Portland season and how you expected it to turn out versus how kind of things did.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as they beat Denver, I was pretty firmly in the camp of they were going to hold on to keep that playoff spot. I know a lot of people were kind of white knuckling along the way. They're getting a little nervous. But I think, you know, the standout moment to me of that whole stretch was, you know, Damian Lillard going for 59 points. I mean, you don't see that very often. In fact, if you're a Blazers fan, you know, you've never seen that ever. I mean, franchise record. And I think, you know, ultimately that final push, you know, even when you take into account, you know, the Nurkic injury, which certainly took some of the steam out of the sails, but that final push to seal up a playoff spot, to, you know, get the record at a spot where, you know, it doesn't quite look as bad as it was looking, you know, for quite a while earlier in the season, it kind of puts Portland in position to be like the ultimate face saving team, you know, this season. And it also gives them a shot at Golden State. And I think if you're trying to spin this positively, you know, if you're the front office, you know, if you could take a game off Golden State in this series, you know, push them to at least 5, then you can say, well, look, you know, we didn't really backslide that far because that's how far we made it last season in the second round against Golden State. And if you, you know, lose the West best team in 5 games, you know, 2 years in a row, it's you know, it's not this horrible catastrophe. Now, I think there's the need for some perspective on that because clearly expectations were different this year. They fell far short of expectations preseason. They, you know, were one of the, you know, worst performing rosters relative to its total cost in terms of the salaries. So they still have to kind of account for that. But I think, you know, they're almost at a point where they're not necessarily only being compared to what people thought was going to be their best case scenario. They should also be compared to what was a very reasonable worst case scenario. And about halfway through that season, these guys looked like they had quit. They didn't look like they were playing with much pride. They didn't look like they were trusting each other defensively. They looked like they were really capped out, you know, and struggling to kind of break this group up and find you know, the long sought answer at center. And they also look like a team that could potentially try to make changes to its front office and its coaching staff. I mean, we definitely talked about that for, you know, a pretty extended portion of the season. That could have been a really ugly summer, you know, if they hadn't been able to turn this around. So I think while you've got to hold Portland accountable for falling short of its expectations earlier and for most likely being kind of first round roadkill here, I think you also have to realize that a lot of teams would have folded, and that could have meant major turnover this summer that I think is no longer going to be necessary.
Yeah, I want to kind of touch on something you brought up there. I mean, there's a lot to really kind of break down, and part of that stems from the article that you wrote for Sports Illustrated a few days ago, kind of outlining how Portland was basically the poster boy for the magical recovery season, so to speak, in that you had a couple teams that Miami most noticeably started out, 11-30, and they ended up going 30-11 to finish the season. I mean, Portland's basically in that same boat. They weren't quite as dire, but I would speculate that a lot of people, both locally and nationally, would have assumed that Portland, even though their record didn't look as bad, their performance on the court was probably for a long-standing period the worst in the NBA. Am I wrong in that view?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're looking at Portland's season in terms of the turnaround, it's not just about this season. I think it's about the amount of changes that could have come very easily if they hadn't had the turnaround. So like with Miami, let's just say they continue stumbling along. Okay, maybe they trade Dragic. It's not like they're going to fire Spoelstra. It's not like Pat Riley's going to be out of a job, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you look at Washington, like they just put Scott Brooks in as their coach. I mean, sure, if they had kept losing and not turned things around and had this great season, you know, maybe they do decide to trade a guy like Bradley Beal, and maybe they decide, oh yeah, you know, Wall and Beal is just never going to work out, right? Like there's the possibility for some, you know, changes there. And maybe even in Washington, they would have decided that, hey, you know, Ernie Grunfeld had his run and it's time for some new blood as the front office. But what we're looking at in Portland with the turnaround is like, you could very realistically have had a scenario where Neil O'Shea got fired, Terry Stotts got fired, everyone gave up on the Dame CJ thing, so CJ has to get traded. The desire, like a really disappointing season would have probably led to a sell-off. So now maybe this summer, guys like Evan Turner and Alan Crabb are just traded for nothing or traded with picks just to get rid of them. I mean, it could have been a real blow up where now you're trying to figure out how can you put the pieces back together around Damian Lillard. And I don't think what I'm saying here, what I'm outlining is really that hyperbolic. I mean, I think all of those things were in play. If they had continued along at the winning percentage they were playing at, really, you know what, through, you know, December and early January.
Yeah, this was a team that was 11 games under 500. And it wasn't like when we talked during that time period, I mean, it wasn't out of the realm of possibility when we talked about it, that losing Stotts, as crazy as that seems now, that was something that was being, you know, bantered about, not just here, but nationally. And while...
Well, it has to be. Crazy. I mean, anytime you're a team that's, you know, in the second round of the playoffs and you come back the next year and you're one of the worst defensive teams and then we're one of the biggest disappointments relative to expectations, like that's what happens, you know, like you face, you know, serious, like, you know, questions at the coaching level and at the management level too. And I mean, part of it was that so many of the decisions were so easily traced to the front office. You know, that is another thing where it's really tricky. Like look at Orlando, you know, the last day of the season, you know, you wake up the next morning and they've already fired their GM because everybody knew it was coming. That could have been a situation that, you know, Neil Olshey found himself in if they had just kind of continued along as one of these big disappointments, because look how many questionable decisions were made last summer. I mean, there was a track record of sort of quote unquote fireable offenses, right? Like if all of those things just blow up in your face, and you got to tell your fan base, hey, we're still committed to trying to win and getting this thing right. You know, someone has to go in those situations. And so, you know, the addition of Nurkic, plus I would say a real renaissance from Damian Lillard. I mean, the Damian of February and March was not the same guy as Damian of December. I know he thinks he was all-star snubbed. Look, if he had played like he's playing in March back in December, he would have been on the all-star team. You know, to me, there's no question about it. And so he's really stepped his game up. He closed strong. And I think, you know, they found a really nice piece in Nurkic to kind of stabilize the defense, get the offense clicking at a little bit of a higher level, and really reinstill some fun too. So that's why I looked at Portland as like the biggest turnaround team, is because they were really like stepping over the edge of the Grand Canyon, basically. Like it was going to be a long, hard fall if they didn't pull themselves back, and they were able to pull themselves back.
See, I'm glad you put it in that kind of frame there, in that this wasn't just Portland salvaging this season and selling a few playoff tickets. This was Portland as an organization salvaging and getting the opportunity to carry on with this rebuild. and not completely derailing it in year two. That's basically what it comes down to, right?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, that's why it goes back to, like, the Dame CJ question. I was, throughout the whole thing, I was always saying, look, the problem is not Dame CJ. You've got to find pieces that can support them, you know, because if you do decide to trade one of those guys, that is a fundamental, you know, shattering of your core group, and you shouldn't do that lightly. With so many other weak links around them, it was always hard for me to get around the notion that they were going to be the problem. I think, you know, the addition of Nurkic and how well those three guys played together and how well the team performed when those three guys were on the court adds some validity to that idea, because it says, look, if you can find the right complementary pieces, if you could find an entire front line of defenders and guys who can stretch well enough and just be complementary pieces, like having two score first, you know, guards in your backcourt, you know, can win enough where maybe you're not on a, you know, title contending level, but you can be, you know, much better than average and, you know, maybe be in the fight next season for like a home court seat. Right. And that again was seriously questioned, you know, not that long ago. And I think if you're, you know, Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, I think you're probably entering the summer thinking like, look, you know, Nurkic has helped solidify our positions together and kind of provided almost like a restored sense of self-confidence or self-worth that, like, yeah, these guys aren't just two random score first guards in a league where everybody's a score first guard. It seems like there's still something special to the, to this pairing, and they can still do, you know, big things, extraordinary things. And, you know, that's also something that, like, Miami, for example, everyone loves the turnaround story in Miami. Like, are you really that excited about the long-term prospects of Goran Dragic and Dion Waiters? No, I would hope not. And I think that is one thing that happened in Washington too, though. I mean, their turnaround really is they finally unlocked that Wall Beal pairing and got both those guys playing on like all-star or near all-star levels. But their roster is older, you know, and that's one reason too, where they're supposed to be winning this year with that roster and everybody stayed healthy. They didn't really have a lot of hiccups. And so when you're contrasting like the Wizards with the Blazers, like, you know, Portland went through a little bit more drama injury wise and certainly more, you know, kind of a more tumultuous season just with the midseason shakeup and the trades, to come out on the other end of that and have your best guys feeling very comfortable about their long term futures. I think that's beneficial if you're the Blazers franchise.
You kind of nailed exactly where I wanted to go with this, and that does the addition of Nurkic, does that make the Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum backcourt viable in that? Not just for the matchup against the Warriors, but going forward, is he enough as far as a two-way player to make it to where the plug-and-play pieces can be built around him? And then these 20 games with him have been fantastic, but, I mean, we're talking, and you and I, when we discuss things like this, we're always talking sample size. But have you seen enough to kind of flip that switch from a maybe to a yes?
Not quite, but you know, he's kind of getting there. I mean, I always say, don't judge me by my best day or my worst day. You know, don't judge any NBA player by his best month or his worst month. And so that's tricky because with Nurkic, like, we've got one absolutely fantastic, unbelievable month, like life-changing month. But we've also got a couple of years of, you know, a body of work that looks quite a bit different than that. So the truth is most likely going to be somewhere in the middle once you're trying to stretch this out over an 82 game season. And another comparison I've used a lot when it comes to Nurkic is like Joel Embiid. I mean, Joel Embiid looked like the best center in the NBA for like 6 or 7 weeks, right? You've got to be able to do it for 82 games. You've got to stay on the court for 82 games. And everyone's got to stay happy, and you've got to be able to kind of keep the positive momentum and just like the good locker room vibes going over the course of, you know, all sorts of ups and downs. And you can't take that kind of stuff for granted. I mean, Nurkic was so consistent as a locker room presence there down the stretch, even doing little things like, you know, popping in the background of, post game interviews and kind of being that goofball. You got to prove that that can hold up too. And not only that's not about him always, it could be about his teammates, who's going to be in a contract year, who isn't, you know, who's jealous of his success. I mean, we saw some of those things backfire in Denver, you know, between him and Jokic. And, so I think from that standpoint, I need to see more. But the early returns are incredibly promising, and they're much more promising than the alternatives, which was you either pay Plumlee to kind of continue, dragging along. you turn the thing over to Myers Leonard, which I think was pretty much a non-starter. You pray that somebody like Noah Vonleh can kind of develop into this like new age starting center, or, you know, you go back out on the free agency market with very limited flexibility and try to add somebody who's, you know, most likely going to not be an impact maker, or you try to construct some dream scenario with a trade where, you know, you're taking back maybe a really expensive specialist to just kind of plug the hole, and you're parting with some, you know, current assets. I mean, none of those other scenarios are nearly as tantalizing, and none of them had the upside of what Nurkic could be if he can deliver on this kind of March level play over the course of the entirety of next season. You know, I didn't see it coming, you know, no question about it. And, you know, but
let's be
you
honest,
can't
nobody
just,
did.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, but,
I've seen plenty of guys who want to give you, you know, this, that, or the other because you didn't rate the trade as the greatest trade ever. I mean, everybody and their mom was looking at that deal and thinking that the draft pick that Portland got for Mason Plumlee was the real gold there.
Yeah, but it's not even just about that, though. Like, I would, like, I, you know, I'm trying to kind of come up with the words, the best way to put this. Like, he still has to prove it, you know, because an 8 seed is not anything to write home about. Like, you were supposed to be a 5 seed, you know. A first-round upset, especially, or a first-round exit, especially if it's sweep, you know, I don't consider that a winning, winning success for a team that spent, you know, over $100 million on its payroll. And nor should anybody. And I know it's a lot better compared to the alternative, but they still have a long way to go. And but I do think, you know, Nurkic, compared to those other alternate scenarios that I laid out, he gives you more faith in the Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum pairing than any of those other scenarios would have given. I mean, like, if it's Myers Leonard, if it's Vonleh, if it's whatever this year's version of Festus Ezeli is, you know, buying somebody cheap because there's health issues, whether it's like even like a guy like Biombo or whoever else you'd be able to trade for as a specialist, you know, the possibility of Nurkic is a lot better than all of those, especially because he's on a cheap contract for next year. So, you know, good. Let's see it, you know, prove it. I mean, the possibility of Embiid is unbelievable too, but he played 31 games and they're right back at the bottom of the lottery again. You know,
trust
both
the process,
those teams.
Ben. Trust the process.
Yeah, both those teams and both those players have a lot to prove next season.
All right, so kind of spinning this forward, the Blazers said that Nurk would be out for at least 2 weeks and then he'd be reevaluated. From a media standpoint, that seems like the dumbest thing possible to say because 3 days after they announced that, they're going to get people asking, is he better? Is he okay? Is he better? Is he okay? And now we're hearing that tomorrow the Blazers are going to make an announcement, R.E. Nurkic and his possible return. Spinning this forward to the Warriors series, do the Blazers, A, gain anything from announcing whether or not he's returning? And B, do you think his return, if he does return, impacts the Blazers enough to steal more than a game?
So the reason why you announce it like they do is because you have a young team that's still in a playoff chase and you don't want to, like, crush their hope, right? Like, you want to let them know, like, hey, help is coming on the way. And you also kind of want to signal to your fan base, like, yeah, he's not out for the entire season. You know, I think, or there's a chance that he comes back. So I think that's kind of why they did it that way. People have been breathlessly following it, like you've been mentioning, as they should, because if they don't have him, they have no hope. I mean, they're going to get completely run off the court. Their small ball lineup is just going to get absolutely destroyed. You know, somebody like JaVale McGee is going to all of a sudden look like an all-star. And, you know, the matchups just get really, really tricky. If I'm Portland, I still think long and hard about whether I even want to bring him back. I mean, clearly he wants to be back out there on the court. There's no question. All indications are it wasn't a very serious injury. I mean, even just the fact that he's been back warming up, making progress, kind of hinting that he's going to come back, suggests that, you know, this was kind of a fluky thing and not, you know, something that they're trying to, you know, minimize or diminish.
Pain management versus, you know, significant chance of re-injury or anything along those lines.
Yeah. I mean, when I first came out, I thought, oh, maybe they're just trying to diminish this and play it down and try to keep everybody's head in the game. But like the way that he's kind of progressed back to pregame workouts and whatever is, you know, obviously it's a positive sign. I mean, if I'm the Blazers, you know, winning one game here, it goes back to that idea of face saving, right? Like this spinning that I was saying before. It's like if you can win one game off the Warriors, then you can say, hey, we kind of ended our season in the same way we did last year. This wasn't a huge disappointment, and now we can build going forward. Is that symbolic value worth, you know, putting, you know, your potential center of the future into any risk health-wise? For me, as an outsider, it probably wouldn't be. But as a team that wants to take its shot and it feel like it has a chance and, you know, build on what was a big turnaround during the regular season, I could see why they would talk themselves into that for sure. It's very tempting. And if it's not a serious re-injury threat, I guess I can see that being, you know, a defensible decision. But in terms of how much is he going to be able to impact this matchup, that remains an open question. You know, I think Golden State is uniquely equipped to pick on him. You know, the issues in terms of turnovers, foul trouble, you know, and ability to play huge minutes, especially if the pace picks up, I think, you know, Golden State can kind of exploit all of those things. But look, Golden State can do that on basically any player in the entire league. I mean, that's not a huge knock on him. Like, whatever your weaknesses are, Golden State's going to find a way to kind of go at them. And I think, you know, their defense, you know, it'd just be interesting to see, do they stay big against him or do they just roll with Draymond? You know, do they let Draymond just try to harass him and bait him into stuff? Or do they keep Zaza out there to just kind of bang with him? He'll probably get a little bit of both. But I don't see him like flipping the matchups in this series. I mean, Golden State's got so many beneficial matchups, whether it's Kevin Durant, who's given the Blazers nightmares this season, whether it's Curry, who's, you know, obviously went nuts last year in Portland,
the guy who scored 40
during
points.
That second round series. Yeah, exactly. And had the greatest overtime basically ever in the Moda Center. You know, Klay Thompson, you know, I think is a much better all around player than any of Portland's, you know, wings. They've got serious advantages at, you know, all the most important positions.
Now, when you look at this matchup, ESPN's got this as a more than 99% favorite for the Warriors. Now, last night, the story that's kind of circling around right now is locally on Comcast Sportsnet, Dan Sheldon asked Damian Lillard, Blazers in six or seven, and Damian Lillard responded, Blazers in six. And, of course, that's the bulletin board material that everybody loves to get as we head into the playoffs. When you look at stuff like this, is this something that Damian Lillard knowingly says, or is this just kind of sheepishly stepping into it?
Well, I wouldn't run away from it if I was him. I mean, you got to have confidence, and he's always had that kind of branding where, you know, like I said, the snub stuff is just always around him, feeling like they're overlooked. I mean, wanting to be a team leader, I don't think it's bad to put yourself out like that. I mean, yes, you're going to get some bullets and some arrows and, oh, you're delusional. And you're going to probably compare it to Brandon Jennings a little bit. But, I mean, they're trying to shock the world, so might as well. You know, I don't really see any major downside to it. I don't think it's a distraction in terms of, their chances. I think the computer models are going to have a tough time here because the head-to-head results were so overwhelming, but they all took place before the trade. And, you know, Portland's stretch of its best play, you know, after the Nurkic trade is not going to really be factored in. So, like, even when you look at, like, the point differential, I mean, the point differential gap between the Warriors and Blazers is one of the widest we've seen in any first-round playoff series of the last decade. I think there's only been one that was wider. And that was the Spurs and Grizzlies last year, and the Spurs swept. But, you know, the Blazers have a pretty strong argument that they're a different team than their point differential suggests, because their point differential was much better after the All-Star break when they had everybody healthy. And they're, you know, that goes right along with the eye test. I mean, they look like a much different team when they had Nurkic on the court, much more competitive team. So I think that this series is going to be closer than the computers suggest. I wouldn't be shocked if Portland was able to get a win in this series at all. And the computer would suggest that, you know, the most likely result is a sweep for sure. But with that being said, it's really hard to talk yourself, even in a best case scenario, into this being a very competitive series. And mostly that says more about Golden State, the fact that they've got Kevin Durant back, the fact that Steph Curry's been unbelievable lately, the fact that they had a really long winning streak, you know, leading into the postseason, although they did drop a game right before that, and just their overall body of work. I mean, look, this is the most dominant team during the regular season by point differential since the 1996 Bulls. That team should smack anybody in the first round, whether it's the Blazers or not.
Yeah, I mean, I keep trying to look for ways that Portland can make this competitive. And I keep coming back to one simple point that everybody points to, in that last year the Blazers, they were in the game for long stretches. But more often than not, there was a single quarter where Golden State absolutely waxed them. And if you step back and take a look at it, that basically means that for 75% of the game, you can play even with a really good team. But that means for 25% of the game, you're so far behind the eight ball that you have no chance. And if that was a situation with last year's team when they missed Steph Curry for two games, they've now added Kevin Durant, who the Blazers have had no answer for, like you've discussed. It's hard, even with Nurkic and the Blazers playing better, to even hope for anything more than a single win. And even that feels like a stretch, even as hard as it is to sweep anybody in the NBA. If you had to pick one or the other, do you think this is more inclined to be a sweep, or do you think the Blazers would probably steal at least one?
I think they can get one. I think my final pick will probably be Warriors in five. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of that Blazers series against the Spurs. Remember San Antonio, I think it was en route to their title, right? It was 2014. I think it was 2014 en route to their title, where that was an unbelievable Spurs team. And they let one drop, I think, in game four in Portland, and then went home and finished it, if I'm not mistaken. I could see a similar thing kind of happening here, where, you know, Golden State maybe gets up 3-0, understands they have the series fully in command, and then drops one. And the same thing happened to Golden State last year when they played the Rockets, and Portland is strong at home. You know, I mean, that is a real home court advantage. You know, I felt the impact of that home court, you know, this past week, you know, being at the Moda Center again and watching, you know, Lillard go for 59, and even, you know, the game before that when they come back and beat the Timberwolves. I mean, not every team has that. You know, in Portland, we take that kind of crowd support for granted. You know, the Clippers would kill for that. You know, there's a lot of teams around the league that would kill to have that. So that makes it tricky. But I still think, you know, Golden State looks locked in. I mean, I could see a similar situation to last year.
You had to call it locked in.
Well, I could see a situation where similar to like the Clippers really blowing Portland out in games one and two of last year's first round. I could see a similar thing happening with Golden State. You know, once they finally can kind of rev things up for this postseason matchup, you know, I could see games one and two being pretty ugly. I think Portland's best chance is back at home.
All right, so let's go ahead and fast forward. Portland's out of the playoffs, and we're looking at Portland's offseason. If you're looking at the Blazers right now, just kind of from 30,000 feet, what does a successful offseason look like for them right now?
I mean, they got to dump some of this money, right? I think, you know, one way or another, I think that especially Turner would be my number one goal to get rid of. You know, I'd be very interested in moving Myers Leonard. I mean, just because his number is smaller, he might be easier to move, even though I don't think there's a ton of interest in him. Crab, you know, I guess in this trade kicker has a lot of people concerned about, hey, maybe he can't be moved or it's going to be tricky. But I would be doing everything possible to use those extra first round picks to try to, undo some of those mistakes, because the overall stretch of this season, you know, outside of the Nurkic renaissance, suggested that this team has a pretty hard ceiling and a lot of these pieces don't fit. And a lot of the money that's tied up is not being very well spent. And so from that standpoint, you know, I would really try to retool those things. And maybe that's wishful thinking. But when they even signed those contracts last summer, I thought, oh, this is going to be a team who kind of lets, you know, lets the chips fall, see who sticks, see who's not worthwhile, and then just moves on from the guys who aren't producing. Well, they've got some pretty clear answers on which guys those might be, and now it's time to kind of pull the trigger and give up on them. If Portland instead just basically decides to use its draft picks to restock, you know, the bottom of the rotation or the bottom of the roster, tries to talk itself into going forward with the same group, and just is going to put all the pressure on Nurkic to save the day and stay healthy next year, to me, that would be a bad offseason. And I could actually see that happening too. You know, I could definitely see Neil being stubborn, not wanting to admit his mistakes, going forward with the same group and facing many of the same problems that they had this season, next season as well.
You mean like signing Nurkic to a contract early and limiting their contract flexibility going forward?
Well, I think if you're Portland, you got to think about doing that though. You know, it's like, what are your other options? Again, it goes back to like your alternates. And that's been a huge problem at that center spot for Portland for years. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think people got so excited about him is that they've cycled through a lot of mediocre to sub-mediocre center options. And I would even include a guy like, you know, Robin Lopez in that mix. But even going back to J.J. Hickson, I mean, there's been a lot of guys
in that spot. The last real center, other than Odin's, probably like, what, Prisbilla?
Yeah, and I mean, Prisbilla, I understand why he is a Portland hero. But like, if you're going around the league as like the best centers, I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty tough. And so, yeah, the stretch of post-Odin centers has been really unsightly. And so, you know, if your choices are try to get Nurkic to lock up and, you know, deal with the pain financially or cap wise or flexibility wise of that, or go back out on the hunt for a center you've never quite been able to find, you know, I could understand why they would kind of lean towards the keep Nurkic at all costs approach.
It's just crazy to kind of think about. If you look at the way the cap's structured, how Portland could legitimately have, because I mean, with the way things are going, Damian will be at 25-ish, CJ will be at almost 28, and if Nurkic, and here's the next question I think that in this evolution is, do you think Nurkic is a max level guy?
If he's healthy, I mean, for a small market team like Portland, he's going to have all the leverage, you know, and he knows they need him, and as crazy as it sounds, like, you know, there's probably somebody out there who's willing to screw with Portland to try to steal him. But I think the best argument for not paying him early is to just see where he shakes out, you know, because you know, there's a chance that, you know, the actual Nurkic is something closer to like 75% or 80% of what he was doing in March. Right. And then that player shouldn't be a max guy. Right. So
you're still pushing probably 20 million a season, but you're not looking at that 28, 29, possibly 30 million when the new cap comes out.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, and this is not against Nurkic, but you got to really think long and hard about paying any center max money at this point, the way the league's going. You know, I mean, small ball is in so big. You know, all the offenses are so guard driven at this point. Most of the money for the star players is going to perimeter guys. You know, that does kind of make you almost on an island if you're going to make that kind of investment. So you really do have to think about it. If I was Portland, the more I'm thinking through this kind of logically in my head, unless he's giving you some crazy discount early, I would let him play out and earn it. Just because, like, if he plays his way into a max contract, that's a good problem to have. If he doesn't, you know, you've probably saved yourself some money by seeing where he lands. So
yeah, I mean, if you're talking it's tricky. 4 years, you're talking, you know, 40 million. If you're talking 10 million a season, you kind of went somewhere with that. With that, I've kind of questioned recently in that I've heard a lot of people discuss the answer to small ball is to go big again. Do you think there's any truth to zigging when other teams zag? If you've got a guy, let's say Nurkic turns into the guy that Damian Lillard says that he can be, that a 20-12-2 guy that basically just dominates. Does that kind of effect, with buoyed or bolstered by Damian and CJ, does that kind of interior threat, is that enough of a change or a force to force some of these teams back into more traditional lineups? With the exception of, say, Golden State, who has, you know, three players that can play three or four positions. I'm talking about basically the rest of the league here.
I mean, I think it's a really good way to, you know, like I said, get to a four seed. You know, I mean, you can be very good if you're punishing teams that don't have that kind of lineup versatility, don't have the ability to be good when they go big. But, you know, you have to be able to play both ways if you're going to be a true contender. And so it goes back to kind of goal setting. You know, you have to have a guy like Nurkic if you want to go head to head with Golden State or Cleveland. I mean, you have to be able to play that way. And you also have to have a really good small ball option at the five, which I don't think Portland has right now, if you want to beat those teams as well, because eventually it is going to downsize. But, you know, Portland's offense in general, in the way that it's structured and the way that it's driven so much by the guards, to me, that's in line with sort of like best practices around the league. So, you know, Nurkic gives you a different look, gives you the ability to go big and gives you ability to protect the paint and kind of just take up space in a way that their previous options just didn't. So it puts them on a better footing if he's able to kind of stay on that level. But, you know, I don't think that you're going to be gleaning some like crazy mismatch advantage every single night against small ball lineups with him. I mean, most teams have somebody they can throw out there to kind of like lessen the damage a little bit. At least most good teams do. But if the goal is to pull out of this sort of like average or mediocre part of the standings and get yourself up into like a top five seed, like, yeah, that seems completely reasonable to me. Based on his impact numbers, I mean, we saw it on both ends, you know, during that stretch, you know, the offense worked much better. It just kind of fit better together, had a better flow. It was getting more contributions from kind of supporting cast guys that were maybe quieter when Plumlee was the guy. And then defensively, there was just a much better structure that never really seemed to be there earlier in the season. So I guess long story short, you know, somebody like Shaq, he, you know, if I'm thinking about Shaq in this modern small ball era, yeah, like, yes, for sure. 100%.
That's
like
the there's a lot of value.
Yeah. There's a lot of value in zigging if your zig is Shaq and everybody else is out there, you know, trying to play guys like, you know, Dragon Bender as their center, right? But I don't really see a lot of talents like that. And even, you know, another example would be like Andre Drummond, right? Like he was supposed to be the next Dwight Howard. How's that working out for Detroit? You know, I mean, he's kind of plateaued. His effectiveness isn't amazing. He's able to get you a bunch of dunks, you know, every night. But you know, just being big isn't enough to be a winner. You know, like that's not enough to kind of like trick everybody who's trying to play small ball. I mean, you've got to have more to it than that. And I think the hope is that maybe Nurkic can have a slightly more refined and diversified game than even a player like Drummond. And, you know, if that's how it turns out, I mean, that is a gigantic home run, and that remains to be seen.
That's kind of where the Blazers become that unicorn franchise in the sense that they get the five that can have the late career renaissance early in their career, pull what Marc Gasol and Pau Gasol have been able to do and stepping away from the hoop and being able to do that while also playing the more traditional big man set. I think, I mean, ultimately that's what it seems like Portland is saying. Terry Stotts has said that he doesn't want Nurkic shooting threes right now, but it's something he wants him to work on in the offseason. So in that vein, I think that you're right in that zigging when you have a Shaq makes sense, but otherwise go with it and see if you can exploit the certain areas of weaknesses that every franchise around the league, save one or two, inherently has within their lineups when they can't guard a true seven-footer anymore.
I mean, Vonley could be the answer. You know, I mean, it could be a situation where 2 years down the road, he is a good enough small ball five where, like, the combination of him and Nurkic just has that position locked, and, like, that's just enough versatility there to get by against basically everybody. I mean, Vonley is going to need to show progress to get there for sure. But if I was Portland's management, that's probably how I'd be leaning towards kind of the future of the five, is like hoping that those are the two guys who are your solutions and they can give you enough where you can fill the rest of the lineups with basically shooters or shooting threats, spread things out around either one of those guys and basically match up fairly well with almost anybody.
All right. Well, that's all the time we got for today. Ben, anything else that you're working on as we get ready here for the NBA playoffs?
Lots of playoff preview stuff. You know, subscribe to the Open Floor Podcast if you can. That's SI's NBA podcast. You know, follow along on Twitter at Ben Golliver, BENGOLLIVER. And then, you know, pass that at SI.com/NBA.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us, Ben. We really appreciate it. And we look forward to talking to you as we get into the Blazers offseason. And hopefully we'll have some better news coming into that time period than we did this time last year.
That sounds good, man. Take care.
Take care, buddy. And, of course, I want to thank Ben Golliver from Sports Illustrated for joining us. It's always great to have his point of view. He's got both a unique take with his background here in Portland and spending a lot of time here, really understands the franchise. But he's also another guy that's, you know, out there in the national market and clearly understands what's going on around the league. So we're always glad to have him on the show, so I want to make sure we thank him. There's certainly a few other points here that we want to, or at least I want to discuss as I'm kind of running solo this week, in that one of the things that Ben and I didn't really get to discuss was the impact of Portland stars and exactly how they've played against Golden State. Damian Lillard's a guy who in Golden State has really just balled out. And this year, just it hasn't really occurred. His scoring average has dropped. His field goal attempts have dropped. Golden State, with, you know, the addition of Kevin Durant, has a seven-footer
that can cover a whole lot of space. And that's another guy that if you run pick and rolls with Durant at the four or the five, you're bringing a guy over who makes life a lot more difficult. Well, a lot of people want to give Kevin Durant his due for his offensive game, and rightfully so. His defense is one of the most underrated aspects of any player in the entire NBA. And Damian Lillard, it's, you know, really 6'1", matching up against a true 7-footer in the pick and roll when you've got, more often than not, Klay Thompson, who's 6'6", 6'7", or Draymond Green coming over to help, who's 6'6", with a 7-foot-plus wingspan. It makes life very, very difficult for him. And that's why it's so huge for guys like CJ McCollum and hopefully Yusuf Nurkic to come out and really play above the fold. Now, CJ's had pretty relative success against the Warriors as far as it compares to his season-long stat range. What we expect out of him, I think with the way Portland is and the way they've been playing, if again, this is all with an asterisk of Nurkic out on the floor, CJ's the guy that really needs to shine even more. If they're going to put Klay on Damian to try and contain him, that really leaves Steph to guard CJ if it's not somebody like Iguodala or somebody like that. So it's kind of a strange situation for how he's going to figure it out or if he's going to figure it out. And it feels strange to talk about it in that sense because CJ's season has been spectacular. David McKay over at Blazers Edge, you know, he brought up the fact that CJ was 2 percentage points away from a 50-40-90 season, shot 48% from the field, over 40% from three, and led the NBA in free throw percentage at 91%. That's insane. I mean, I'm still going to go through and check all the numbers, but I can't think of many players in NBA history who have been the type of volume shooter that CJ is that has had that kind of season. So one thing, at least for me, that I'm looking forward to here is hoping that CJ finds that next gear. CJ right now is a star in the NBA. He is an offensive star, but he's not a superstar. And the playoffs are where you become a superstar. Now, 21, 22 points a game, 4 rebounds, 4 assists. Yeah, those are really good numbers. Those are better than most guys in the league are ever going to put up. And it's crazy to think about it, but in today's NBA, that puts you on the bottom of the pile for the star wing players. I mean, you look around what these guys are doing, and it's absolutely insane. And for Portland to be successful, he needs to get to that insane category. Dame and CJ need to combine for at least 55 a game. That's bare minimum, and that's normal. So to elevate that, you're looking at them 62 to 65 a game for them to really play with the Warriors because they don't have the defense to stop them, they can't really outscore them all the way. But what they can do is they can change the pace and the tempo of the game with Nurkic again if he's healthy. And the impact that he can have on the game, particularly as it pertains to Dame and CJ, is huge. And I think for me, that's the one big takeaway from the stars coming into this game. Now, it's not a huge secret that I don't give the Trailblazers much of a chance. But you know, the fan inside of me wants the Blazers to do well. I want them to perform on the national stage. I don't want them to be embarrassed. Because if they're absolutely embarrassed, it becomes a problem. I don't want the Blazers to sell me anything. But I think it's important for them to be able to point to something and to have hope. And even though I didn't think they were going to repeat the second half of last season's success for an entire 82 games this past season, it still felt like there would be a natural growth. And if they go out and just get absolutely smashed, it's one of those things that's not only disheartening, there's just no way you can really spin that into breeding success going into next year. Last year was all about hope. Last year, they upset the Clippers. And yes, Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, all, everything that came in with that. But it's still a win in the first round and in the 30,000-foot view. And even though they got smashed in periods against the Warriors, there were times where they performed well. So you could point to particular areas and particular times for long stretches where you could say that, okay, we're not there yet. But as a team, that they're building on it. And I think that's important for Portland. I'm not a big fan of moral victories.
But I think they do need to prove not only to themselves but to the fan base and to the front office that this is something that's worth building on. If Nurkic doesn't play, it's going to be nasty. If Nurkic plays, it could still be nasty, but there might be something there. There may be two games where the three of them, Nurkic, Lillard, and McCollum, just absolutely ball out, and the Warriors really struggle to contain them. And then on the defensive side of things, you see Lillard and McCollum be at least even. And that's all I think we really ever asked of those two guys on the defensive side of the ball, is to just not be complete sieves. So if Nurkic is healthy and on both ends allows those guys to really get going, and then for him, he finds a way to get going and kind of flips the script on the whole small ball dynamic, then from there, there's a big chance that you could really see something happen. And I think really going forward, that's what they're looking for. And I don't look for something along the lines of an Al-Farouq Aminu discovering a shot like he did, you know, in the playoffs, where he had a couple games where he was absolutely crazy, and then he had a couple games where he was absolutely not. Maurice Harkless, we've seen him perform well. Alan Crabb, he's the guy you may expect to see a little bit more from since he's been more aggressive as the season has come to a close here. But you're not sitting here like, okay, let's see what we got in those guys. You kind of know what you have. You hope a guy like Myers Leonard over the last few days has had enough time to kind of get his back right, get his hip right, and you get a little bit more out of him. You're hoping that Alan Crabb takes and makes the shots that he should take and doesn't hesitate. But beyond that, this isn't a season of hoping that guys develop. You're hoping they cement the roles that they are. And I think that's a vast difference from what they were going into the playoffs last year. You were wondering, okay, how are Dame and CJ going to perform against Chris Paul, JJ Redick? You know, what is this really going to be like? Because there was that time in the Memphis series 2 seasons ago where CJ showed a little bit of it, and that's where it kind of came from. And really, these other guys, they've been there. So there's nobody new other than Evan Turner. And Evan Turner is a guy that's been there before. And he's had success at times in the playoffs, but he's also kind of been the GOAT. And we're not talking about the good GOAT here. So you're looking for these guys to solidify their roles. And if the big three of McCollum, Lillard, and Nurkic can really put it together, then you're hoping that this is the foundation, this is the hope. Even if they drop the series, that kind of gives you something to springboard you into the offseason. These guys aren't going on vacation with their heads down, and I don't think that's necessarily going to be it, but I don't necessarily want to feed into the hashtag they. I don't want to give them the chip on the shoulder because they played like crap. That just doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun for them or for the fan base or the organization, although it would be kind of entertaining to watch Neil O'Shea try to spin a 4-0 sweep. If there's any solace to be gained from some kind of schlacking like that, if Nurkic doesn't play and he can't point to that, that one might be a little bit entertaining to see how that one comes out. But I mean, that's just me, and I'm a bit of a masochist. So really where that kind of goes, that's my whole kind of take on this playoff series. And we'll do more game by game as I come along, and we'll bring on various guests to kind of break down what we've seen and what happened and what transpired and how Portland can react, because every one of these games is different. The different tones, different tempos. If you're looking for something, I mean, Nurkic brings a little bit of nasty. And if we're talking about things on the peripherals, I'm hoping he doesn't take anything from anybody like a guy like Draymond Green or Zaza Pachulia, but I hope he also keeps his cool while also stepping on some toes. I want to see the Bosnian beast embrace the beast. And I think that's a smaller thing, but I think it's bigger grand scheme for Portland. When you've got a guy that's your tone setter, that's something that I think Portland can build upon going forward, and let's just hope that he's healthy enough to go ahead and make that happen. But now I want to go ahead and turn to something a little bit more fun. I've been talking to a few guys that have kind of urged me on to do this lately, and that's the NBA Netflix. And really, this has come from a conglomeration of guys that have kind of gone back and forth where, You know, you take any particular situation or player, and you wonder what it would be like if you were going to go ahead and take one of these guys, and, you know, whether it was something that's happened to them or something that's just kind of awkward or offbeat, and you just kind of plug them in as a movie character. And it's so perfect and poignant, particularly with what's going on in the NBA, particularly with the New York Knicks lately. I got to credit Steve DeWald over at Blazers Edge. He's the one that gave this one to me and kind of inspired this whole thing going forward. And once we get a few of these rolling, we're going to go ahead and put some out there and ask for others to give us some feedback. So basically, you want to give the premise and then insert the player, coach, character, or whatever into the movie role, and just because of what's been going on. And basically, Steve's whole idea was, in the M. Night Shyamalan universe, Phil Jackson escapes the village to realize the world has advanced past the triangle. I mean, if you've ever seen The Village and how isolated and contained it is within its own world, you can see how distant a guy like Phil Jackson has become, especially with the way his recent press conference has gone. And it just shows how ridiculously separated he is from the Knicks. I mean, it's just kind of hilarious how some of these caricatures just kind of, they paint these things that are so perfect within their own world. And this kind of, like I said, it's kind of kicked off and it led into some Blazers ones. And I love Evan Turner as both a person, the player. I just don't like the fit in Portland. But when the Blazers first acquired him, the thing I kept thinking of was Will Smith's character in Hancock. And in the beginning of that movie, nobody likes Hancock. And by the end, though, you learn to embrace who he is and what he is and what he stands for and what he's there to do. And I just see Evan Turner as Hancock. He's not the hero you want, but he may not even be the hero you need, but he's the hero that you have. And whether or not you want to discuss how he's kind of fit into that, he is who he is. And I think the sooner the Blazers embraced that idea, that was kind of where it all came from. Now, to totally flip that on its head, Ben Golliver, who was the guy, I want to give him credit here, because I believe Ben was the guy that coined the name Cupcakes for Raymond Felton. So we wanted to kind of take a little play off of that and go with Raymond Felton and how, you know, I mean, I'm a big dude, so I can make fun of big dudes as well. Raymond Felton walks in Morgan Spurlock's shoes in Super Size Me 2.0. I mean, you could take it away from McDonald's and target the cupcake industry. Or, you know, if you wanted to keep it Portland local, you could target Voodoo Donuts or Blue Star, whatever one you want to call home. But I could easily see that one playing over as Raymond Felton, you know, eggs people on to come fight him. That's a remake that definitely needs to happen. A classic, you know, a movie like The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, you could definitely see that one as a possibility. You'd have to stick a guy like Roy Hibbert in there as a guy who's a game has just totally passed him by. And it's sad but kind of true. As Roy's tried to make a comeback, remember, this is a guy that the Trailblazers tried to sign to a max contract just a few years ago. That's another, we'll go ahead and put that up. I got to come up with one for Neil O'Shea as a bullet dodger, because the amount of guys he's tried to sign to contracts that haven't signed have been so by the grace of God. So it's one of those things where you just kind of keep coming up with these, and the more ridiculous they get, it's kind of amazing how true to form they become. The one that maybe fits a little bit more recently here with Portland, this one was given to me, was Yusuf Nurkic in the remake of Borat. You know, a guy leaves purgatory and travels west and finds finds how good things are can be on the west side, and truly goes through some tumultuous times, but kind of figures it out. And I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up with that one. I don't know how well this is going to play out, but it was something that made me laugh for a long time as we went back and forth with these. So if you guys have got any, go ahead and shoot them our way at Trailing Blazers. go ahead and type it in with NBA, hashtag NBA Netflix, and we'll go ahead and see what comes out of it. Again, you can find us on Twitter on at Trailing Blazers, on Facebook on Trailing Blazers, or you can send it directly to me at DMarang on Twitter. And I just want to thank you guys for joining us this week. This has been Trailing Blazers on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, now a part of Dash Radio. And we'll go ahead and wrap it up here, and we'll tie things up as the Blazers come back off of Game 1 on Sunday afternoon. We'll probably record Sunday night, and we'll look forward to talking to you there.